I want to thank Bob for inviting me back and let you know what a pleasure it is to be here with you this morning. Nanotechnology, and Bob used this term, ubiquitous, and at the end of the day, material science is also ubiquitous, and hence the relationships, they're constantly crossing paths. So what I'm going to talk to you today about is this intersection of material science and engineering with nanotechnology. Because really, at the end of the day, it's material science and engineering that's at the forefront of pushing nanotechnology and developing these new products and new ideas. So I titled my talk, How the Smallest Building Blocks Are Impacting Life Today and Tomorrow. And so first I'm going to start off with a brief explanation of what is a material and what is material science and engineering. And this is actually sort of important because I've been in this field for 20 plus years and my parents still don't understand what I do for a living. So, and they're coming up on Thursday, so I take another crack at it. But one of the very unique things about our field is that there's both science and engineering in the title, and that's very important, and it's very strategic in how we educate our students. And then I'll give you a really mundane example, since everything is going to be really high-tech and make our heads swim. I'll start with something really simple, a turkey timer. And then we'll get into, you know, why we're all here, right? Because we're big Mork and Mindy fans. I just dated myself there, didn't I? But we'll talk about nano and the interest and how we're making materials, and then I'll talk about some products that you might have heard of or might not have heard of, and I'll hit a little bit on the research, but you're going to be seeing a lot of that today. And actually, you're going to be hearing from a colleague of mine at the end of this session, Dr. James Adair, who's revolutionizing the way that we image the human body and treat cancer using nanotechnology. So I'll give you a little teaser on that, and then you'll see more of him.
Maybe I'll stay around till Wednesday then,
Yeah.
Birthday.
Yeah, that way you'll want to stay so you can hear what he has to say. Okay, so let's get going. All right, so ceramics, so materials, typically we throw them into three categories: ceramics, metals, and polymers. And ceramics tend to be, I joke because I've spent most of my career in ceramics, I call them the trash bin of the materials world, because it's pretty obvious what a metal is. That's two-thirds of the periodic table. And what a polymer is fairly easy concept for most people. So a ceramic, if it's not a metal, if it's not a polymer, must be a ceramic. All right. But a good working definition is anytime I bond a metal to a non-metal, that's a ceramic. So you have ionic bonds, covalent bonds, of course, van der Waals are always there. They exhibit really high stiffness, but essentially no toughness, hence why you drop your mom's china plate, it shatters into a million pieces. They're insulators. They don't conduct electricity. They don't conduct heat. Make really good coffee cups. And they have high temperature capabilities, and they are typically highly chemically resistant, unless the chemical you're talking about is water, in which case, they're horrible in water. All right. Metals, like I said, two-thirds of the periodic table. All right, we think of metals as this metallic bonding, sharing of electrons, which I would argue is simply a subset of covalent, but that's a discussion for another day. Metals pure, we don't tend to work with, all right? Not very good engineering materials. But if we start mixing metals and creating alloys, now we can create some really interesting properties and materials. We get high strength, but we can also have toughness and ductility. We can engineer the stiffness and toughness, and we can do that both at the atomic scale and the microstructural scale. And of course, metals are conductors. Polymers, long carbon chains, doesn't have to be carbon, but 9 times out of 10 it is. Covalent bonds within the chains, covalent and van der Waals bonds in between. Low stiffness, but high ductility. These are low temperature materials, though. I mean, typically, if you're thinking about an application, right? Someone says, I need a material that can do this, all right? And the surface temperature is above 300 degrees Celsius. Well, I've pretty much thrown all my polymers out the window. Although, I will show you how nanotechnology is changing that paradigm, too. And their performance is highly dependent on the molecular weight and their degree of crystallinity. So how do we think about things in material science? Well, it comes down to processing, structure, properties, and performance. All right. So in the field, you will find people who work in only one area, and then there are people who work across the entire life cycle. So when I think about processing, I'm thinking about how do I make a material. So there's a lot of chemistry, thermodynamics, kinetics, transport phenomena, things of that nature. Well, how I take these raw materials and start processing them into something that's useful is then going to dictate what kind of structure I have. When I say structure, I mean atomic structure. All right. One of the things that sets material science and engineering apart from any other engineering discipline is scale. All right. We engineer, but we engineer at the atomic scale. And so we're building things atoms at a time. Then, of course, whatever that structure is going to dictate what kind of properties you have. So while I say ceramics don't conduct, if I do a little bit of manipulation, I can make you ceramics that conduct, all right? And vice versa, metals conduct, but if I do a little manipulation, I can make the metal not very conductive either, all right? And then, of course, this all leads to the end-all, be-all, which is performance, right? The application and how we're going to use it. So this is material science in a nutshell. Let's apply it, all right, from the point of view of science and engineering. So typically, I would argue that engineering answers the question how, and science answers the question why. And so we train our students to pursue both of those answers. All right. So it's not only that they're solving engineering problems, but they understand the science, the phenomena behind why one material is a good choice or multiple materials are a good choice. And an example might be is and this is sort of the systems point of view. But if I ask for you to create a hard surface to which you are going to hit an object, typically an engineer is going to think from a systems point of view. So I need the object that's doing the hitting, and I need the object that's going to be hit, and I need to develop some kind of apparatus that generates power so that when I'm hitting something, I have accuracy and I have power. And so that's going to set up, that's going to answer the question of how I'm going to construct this. But the science, it takes individual parts of the system and says, well, okay, here's the hammer. Can I do something to make the hammer harder? All right, so that when I generate the power in the hammer and the hammer hits the object, more of the energy goes into the object and less goes back into the hammer. All right, so I make a more efficient process. And so let's look at this from something that's really mundane, but will give you a talking point the next time you're cooking a turkey. And that's a turkey timer, all right? And there's actually some pretty interesting material science in a turkey timer. So let's think about this once again from the problem-solving point of view. So you have a bird, a rather large bird for most people, and you're going to stick it in your oven, and you need to know when the internal temperature of the meat of that bird has reached 165 degrees Fahrenheit. How do you do that? All right? So, you know, in today's day and age, you know, a student might say, okay, well, I'll just find some iPad or, you know, iPhone app, you know, that'll, you know. But let me tell you, electronics don't react well with 350, 400 degrees Fahrenheit. So so the iPad apps are pretty much out the window. So what we need is some kind of visual indicator, but we need it to be mechanically driven because, well, I can't stick my iPhone into the oven to tell me when the bird is done. And so the engineer would say, okay, well, let's get some kind of visual indicator, a popper. We'll load a spring, so we have this potential energy, and then we'll solidify the popper in something that when the appropriate temperature is met, it'll be released. All right? And so a turkey timer actually uses a piece of metal in the bottom of the turkey timer, and that piece of metal is designed to melt at 185 degrees Fahrenheit. All right? So, okay, that sounds all well and good. Let's go look at the periodic table and find me a metal that melts at 185 degrees Fahrenheit. It doesn't exist. All right? There are plenty of metals that melt above that, and there are plenty of metals that melt below that, but there's no metal that actually melts at that temperature. So now we are looking at engineering a new metal, which we'll call an alloy. And so this, these alloys, these low-temperature alloys, actually have a long history. There was a metallurgist in the mid-1800s called named Wood, and he created what were called Wood's metals. And Wood's metals were these low-temperature metals, which almost all of our solder chemistries are based on. And but there was a major drawback to Wood's metals. All right, the two main components were lead and antimony, two things that you don't want in your food, all right, and two things that you don't typically want your students playing around with either. Okay, and so Fields is a metallurgist in Canada, and he saw that this was an issue, and so he developed his own system of low-temperature metals, but he took away the lead and antimony and used bismuth, tin, and indium. And so, actually, a couple of years ago, I had a group of juniors, and I gave them a turkey timer, all right? They'd just gone through a junior lab, and I gave them this turkey timer. None of them in the group knew what it was, because they'd never seen it outside the turkey. And then I said, I want you to figure out what's in there. So it was their end of semester project. I want you to identify all the materials that are inside this and explain to me how it works. And so they, after a little bit of examination, they figured out, you know, the Google, hey, that's a nice tool, right? So after going at the Google, they figured, oh, there's a piece of metal in there. And so what they did is they clipped off the pointy end and they polished it. And what was left behind is this cross section. So this outer circle is the plastic, and in here is the piece of metal. And then they took this piece that they had prepared and they put it in an electron microscope, which you guys are going to be working with later this week. Well, an electron microscope is a fascinating instrument because not only does it allow us to image, but as you can imagine, when I take a bunch of high-powered electrons and I beat the crap out of the surface of something, more than just pictures come back at me. All right. There's a lot of different signals and interactions that go on, and I can use that information to characterize. And one of the things that happens is those high-energy electrons, they go in and they kick out an inner shell electron. All right. Well, now the atom is in a high-energy state, which, of course, we know Mother Nature abhors. And so a higher shell electron is going to relax and fill that place. Well, when it relaxes, it has to release that energy. That energy is in the form of an X-ray, and that X-ray has a characteristic wavelength associated with the orbital from which it came and the atom from which it originated. And that we can use as a fingerprint. And so the students, and this type of analysis is called energy dispersive spectroscopy. And so the students put their sample in the scanning electron microscope, perform EDS, and lo and behold, they see peaks for indium, bismuth, and tin. Then, if you're really careful and you calibrate your instrument appropriately, you can actually back out concentrations. And so you see on the left side here, we have Fields' original metal, which melted at 144 degrees Fahrenheit. So that doesn't help me inside the turkey. And then you see the turkey timer, which melts at 185. 185 because, yeah, I'm leaving myself room for error, right? I got to get to 165. And you see the big difference between the two is the change in indium and tin, and that can easily be explained by the respective melting temperatures of those two metals. All right? And so there's a whole course worth of material science that goes into this, which we won't go into, but phase diagrams and different parts of the phase diagram and what are you looking for and where the low melting areas, and are you creating a homogeneous alloy, or are you going to precipitate out second phases, blah, blah, blah. So it's you know, this is a really streamed down, you know, version of it, but this is the question, you know, this is essentially the case in a nutshell. So that's material science, all right? At a very mundane and not very exciting level, but great for turkey table conversation. So nanoscience, nanotechnology, right? We're all familiar with nano, I think. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't be in the room, right? So we've heard of it, and you know, generally from a material science point of view, if I'm talking nanotechnology, I'm talking something smaller than 100 nanometers. And so, why do we care about this? Well, it's cross-disciplinary, all right? So not only do you have this impacting the sciences, but you also have it impacting the soft sciences side as well. I mean, obviously, you know, the top one there is why we're all here today, education, learning about this and then transporting this information to other people. But it's having a huge impact, obviously, on business. Otherwise, why would there be so many industry partners who are wanting to get involved in this center? But then you also have, you know, the psychology, sociology, and philosophy of these things, right? If I'm being exposed to these materials, am I at greater risk? Are there ethical questions about using some of these things? I mean, for instance, you know, some of the technologies that are being developed for treating cancer and delivering drugs, these nanoparticles, once you put them in the body, they're never leaving. The body has no way of metastasizing them, all right? And not only that, they're so small, all right? They're smaller than viruses, they're smaller than bacteria, so the body's immune system doesn't even know they're there. All right, which could be a blessing and a curse, depending on what you're how you're looking at it. So there are a lot of questions that go into this that, you know, for better or for worse, you know, engineers sometimes aren't comfortable tackling. So it's really opened our eyes to the bigger implications. So one of the number one reasons that we get fascinated about going down to the nanoscale is that as we decrease the size of the particles that we work with, all right, almost everything I make as a material scientist starts as a powder, all right? And then I put those powder particles together, I consolidate them in some process that typically involves heat, and what I'm left with is a solid monolithic surface like this tabletop, all right? And so as we go down to the nanoscale, our particles get really small, but our surface area gets really high, all right? And it's sort of counterintuitive. So the way that I like to talk about it with students is I say, look at these two vials of jars of marbles. So here on the left, I have 3,000 marbles, and they have a size of 5/8 inch in diameter, but on the right, same jar, same size, same volume, but now I can get 5,000 marbles in there because they're only at half an inch in diameter, all right? And the same holds true as I decrease the size of these particles. Now, interestingly enough, this becomes a challenge for us because once again, I've already referenced to Mother Nature. I have a huge amount of respect for her, but Mother Nature abhors a high energy system, all right? Well, if I increase surface area, I increase the potential for chemical reactions to take place. I increase the surface energy, all right? So Mother Nature's not going to be too keen on that. So one of the challenges in nanoscience and nanotechnology is once you make the things small, which, by the way, is trivial, is keeping them apart, all right? So when I make these really small particles, if I'm not careful, Mother Nature is immediately going to try to stick them back together again to try to decrease the surface area. And, oh, by the way, once she does that, short of a nuclear blast, I'm not separating them again. I mean, it's an incredible amount of energy that goes into the bonding between these particles. So this is something that I have to battle on a constant basis. And, of course, the other reason that we're interested in going to small scales is because you start to see some really interesting phenomena that we just don't observe at the macro scale. For instance, here is a series of cadmium selenide quantum dots, and you see, as the size of these quantum dots increases, I see different emissions of color. Right? Well, that's pretty cool. Right? Of course, we've been doing that for 2,000 years. I'll explain how in a second. But let's go back to this idea of these really, really small particles. So here is a transmission electron microscope of some these are tetragonal, zirconia particles. That's not really important. But what is important is you see the measure bar, right? And it indicates that length is 8 nanometers. So you can see those particles are on the order of 5 to 12 nanometers, depending on where you measure, all right? And so typically, in most modern-day processes, the powders that we work with in the ceramics industry are on the order of 1 to 10 micrometers in size. And so now, when you have particles that are 8 nanometers in size, you've actually reduced by 1,000 the size of these particles, all right? And this is the other thing that I want to hint to you before I go much further, orders of magnitude, all right? That's the other thing that's sort of exciting about nanoscience and nanotechnology, is not only do we see these fascinating changes, but these changes represent orders of magnitude in, hopefully, improvement, sometimes not. But that's typically what we're going for. So a typical ceramic powder that's worked with in industry has a surface area of 1 meter squared per gram. So these particles that are on the average of 8 nanometers have 130 meters squared per gram, all right? And that number probably doesn't mean too much to you, because how many people work in units of meter squared per gram? So what does that physically mean? Well, if I created a little cube that was 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter, and I filled it to the top with powder, the equivalent surface area of the powder in that little cube would be 1,400 square feet. You think about that, right? I mean, that's the size of most people's homes. Actually, I guess it's probably about half the size. The average home in America now is approaching 2,800 square feet. But 1,400 square feet in a little cube like that. Wow, mind-boggling, all right? So you can, once again, you can start to see why we're getting a little excited about this. You know, once again, going back to the history of this, we've been using nanotechnology for 2,000 years. We just didn't know we were doing it, all right? And actually, Bob hit on this, and I'm going to hit on it a little bit more, but part of this is technology. All right, we just didn't have the way to characterize an image and investigate these size scales. But in fact, in early glass coloring, they were actually, what was happening is, because of the source of where they were getting their materials, they had contaminants of gold. And the gold contaminants were such that they were on a size of orders of nanometers, so not tens of nanometers, but nanometers. And these gold, what we call colloids, actually cause color changes depending on their size. And this was a way that that they colored glass. Of course, they didn't know. They knew what they were doing to get the colors, but they didn't know why. They didn't know what was going on. And heck, we've really only understood it for the last 40 years. I mean, think about that. Something that was done 2,000 years ago, and it's only really been in the last 40 years that we've had any concept of what was actually going on scientifically to allow this to take place. So, you know, Bob has hit on this, but, you know, obviously material science and engineering, as well as nanotechnology, has many different career pathways that students can follow. So, Let's get to the exciting part. Why do we really care? So we care about nanoscience and nanotechnology because we can make things smaller, and hence we can make things cheaper, right? And this is actually a really important point. For instance, has anybody been following the discussion about rare earths? Right? There's a lot of hubbub about rare earth metals and how these metals have a lot of potential for us because they can actually act as a substitute for some of the more core materials that we use. And people are a little excited about it because, well, okay, these rare earths only exist in certain areas, and unfortunately for the United States, quite a few of these areas are in places that they don't really care for us too much. And so what are we going to do? Well, at the end of the day, the amount of these rare earths that I need is trivial to make one of these devices, all right? So while there are people getting excited about these things, you have to avoid the hype a little bit. But let's take a look at this. So everybody's holding one of these cell phones, right? And let's think about all the things that this cell phone does for us today. And let's think about what these things used to look like, right? So it's a portable GPS, all right? It's also a camera that does both video and still life, right? It's a calculator. This is mind-boggling. It's a gaming device. All right, and it's so funny. I mean, the kids really get a kick out of this. Most of my students don't even know what this Game Boy is anymore, right? I mean, this is so 20th century. Come on, right? And then we have our portable music player, and of course, the best, the cell phone, right? And you take all of those technologies. You take all of those technologies that I've shown you. All right, when they first came out, you're talking about millions of dollars, right? And now all of those things are in a device that fits in the palm of my hand. And, in some cases, depending on what phone system you were, you didn't pay anything for that phone, right? I mean, it's sort of not the iPhone. The iPhone's always expensive. But, the phone I'm carrying right now, I got on a what do they call it, the Red Monday or something, so it was after Black Friday, it was an online, so I paid nothing for this, right? It's absolutely amazing. Once again, talk about the social science side, all right? I paid nothing for this phone, which also means that everything that goes into this phone has been externalized, right? The natural resources that went into it, how am I going to handle this phone when it's no longer serving its useful purpose? All of these things, we've just assumed someone else will cover. All right? There's a major ethical question. All right? And a sustainability one. But anyway, so we get really excited about this systems integration, and as we should. Although I will say that this is... It's sort of interesting where we're going, if you think about it, right? I'm one of these people, I'm a time management, anal retentive about it, really. And so all through my undergrad years, I carried around this big black binder that was my calendar. I mean, it was my entire life, right? I had credit cards in there, money in there, IDs in there, and it went with me everywhere, which was not great for date nights. But it was always with me, right? And I was one of the, I bought one of the first Palm devices. Anybody remember Palm Pilots, right?
I had an Apple Newton before that.
Yeah. So you're talking about, green monochrome screen, right? I think measured memory in kilobytes, not gigabytes or megabytes. And, I thought that was just the most amazing thing ever, right? I've gone from this huge black thing the size of a Bible to, this device that fit in my pocket, all right? And then along came cell phones. And so now you have the cell phone, and you have the PDA, and you're always lamenting, why do I have to carry around both of these things? Why can't I just stick them together? Hey, smartphones, right? But now look where we're going. So it's not enough for this phone to do all the things it does. Now we want it to start being our own personal computer. And you notice the things are getting bigger, right? It's actually, we've lost this idea of miniaturization all of a sudden, and now I want, a tablet that is my phone and does everything else, and they're getting bigger. It's sort of fascinating. But I'm sure they'll start shrinking again. Eventually we'll be wearing them in glasses or implanted in the back of our heads, depending on if you're a conspiracy theorist or not. So, and this nanotechnology is around us everywhere, all right? Quantum well lasers. So this slide is all about their computer. All right. So the quantum well laser is the laser of choice in your hard drives. All right. And the quantum well laser gets its name from the fact that I can design these wells on a size scale of 6 nanometers. I actually get quantum confinement. I can actually attract the electron and trap it there, and then have this recombination, which is going to emit a wavelength of light. All right? And that wavelength of light, from a memory point of view, I want the wavelength to be as small as possible, because then I can do an examination of smaller or higher density storages. And so not only can we control the wavelength of the light by the band gap, which is how we traditionally think of lasers, but we can also control the wavelength by the width of these wells. All right? And so this is the technology that enabled things like Blu-ray, you know, and the next generation of DVD players and things of that nature. And then, of course, you have the transistor. Well, the solid-state transistor has been around. I mean, that's so old school, right? But fascinatingly enough, the nanotechnology here is the gate material, the gate oxide. And actually, I'm going to talk about this a little bit in depth in a second, because we're actually pushing the technology. All right, we've actually, you know, silicon has just about run its natural course. All right, and the people who are thinking are trying to find things beyond silicon. Actually, it's sort of interesting because the solar industry is not doing this. The solar industry is like, silicon's the end all be all. Why would you look at cadmium selenide or tin sulfide or any of those other things? Because silicon does such a great job. A little short-sighted, but they'll get there. So these gate materials are on the order of 4 nanometers, all right? And there are literally billions and billions of these. So, you know, once again, a student asks you, is there anything really nano about the iPod Nano? Yeah, and it's the memory. It's the transistors and the oxide layer that goes in there. And then you have the actual hard disk, which is absolutely amazing, but represents another wonderful way of scaling up nano so that your students can understand it. Let me explain. So you have your magnetic, your medium that's storing your information, and the grains on this are on the order of 10 nanometers. So, and a grain is basically your 1-0, all right? And so you have an arm. I don't know if you've ever taken apart a hard drive. I highly recommend it. You'll need some jeweler's tools, but it's fascinating stuff. So anyway, you got this really shiny silver disc. That's one of the things you'll see. And then you have this arm, and this arm is driven by a magnet, and at the end of this arm is a little needle, and the needle is responsible for reading each of those magnetic grains to see if there's a 1 or a 0, all right? And so the needle on the end of this arm is about 1 micrometer in length, okay? So this system, current day hard drives spin at upwards of 15,000 RPMs. And so what they actually do, this arm is aerodynamically designed such that it flies. And it flies based on the wind currents that are being generated by this disk spinning at 15,000 RPMs. All right? And so when it flies, it levitates. And it levitates about 7 nanometers above the surface of that spinning disk. Talk about redefining the definition of smooth. Right? Is that smooth? It's okay. Is that smooth? That's better. All right? Think about atomic smooth. Think about, you know, one step being the size of an atom. That's the kind of atomic smoothness we're talking about. All right, so we have the silver disk spinning at 15,000 RPMs. We have an arm levitating 7 nanometers above that with a 1 micrometer length needle that's looking at all these grains inside the disk that are 10 nanometers in size. So let's scale that up, because once again, I can't fathom a nanometer, right? So if we were to scale that up, we're going to make this arm a 747 airliner, all right? And to replicate this system, what you would have is a 747 airliner traveling at 800 times the speed of sound, 1/10 of an inch above the surface of the Earth. And while it's doing that, it's looking at every single blade of grass for a 1 or a 0. All right? Wow. And that's what's going on in your hard drive every time you turn it on. Another interesting note. Have you ever wondered why computers have a shutdown process? All right. One of the reasons they have a shutdown process is because if that needle stops levitating and comes into contact with that spinning disk, it will harm it. So the shutdown system is actually done so that the computer can align that spinning disk such that when the needle finally comes to rest, it comes to rest in an area where no data is stored. So those spinning disks literally have a runway for this device that's flying. I mean, really cool stuff. But we're starting to push the envelope, all right? So here is an idea. Here's a transistor. We have the gate material, and this is our channel, our gate oxide. And the problem is that we are now approaching layers that are so thin that the electron doesn't stop anymore, right? The whole process, the whole point of this is that I can manipulate an electron, which is mind-boggling in and of itself, right? Because I'm talking about something I don't even assign a mass to because it's so freakishly small, all right? But as we get to this below 4 nanometer scale, this silicon oxide layer, which is typically what the gate material is, no longer works because the electron just penetrates right through it. And that's called leakage. And that wastes power, which wastes energy, which is not sustainable. All right? And so this is where the next revolution is. What are we going to replace silicon with? All right? Graphene is a very exciting material. Got the Physics Nobel Prize in 2010. A lot of people working on that. Even graphene is starting to reach some of its limits, and people are looking for other structures that repeat the graphene structure but are not based on carbon. All right? So there's a lot of really exciting cutting-edge technology. How do you do this? So now what I want to do is introduce you to a technique that you're not going to see during this workshop, but you'll see some sister techniques that are very similar to it. But I don't know if you've ever wondered, you know, when I watch the Star Treks and the Star Wars, and I what material is going to get me my lightsaber, you know? What material is going to allow me to transport a human being, a solid object, from one place to another instantaneously? What materials will do that? Well, let me tell you, those materials don't exist, all right? And what I'm getting ready to show you now is the technique that allows us to make materials that have never existed in the history of humankind. All right? And it's called molecular beam epitaxy. And one of the reasons that we're so excited about it, this was a paper published by Schlom et al. And Schlom was once here at Penn State. He's now at Corning. This is fascinating. So what we have here is two ceramics. All right, so there's an lanthanum aluminum oxide and a strontium titanate. All right, they're ceramics. They don't conduct. Not only do they not conduct, but their conduction is so low, we can't even measure it. It's below detection limits. But it just so happened that one day, these researchers were putting these two layers together, and where those layers met at the interface, the conductivity jumped over 4 orders of magnitude. 4 orders. I don't care who you are, but if you're a scientist, 4 orders of magnitude gets you pretty excited. All right? And the fact that they could even find this is, I mean, needle in a haystack doesn't even come close to explaining the size that we're looking at. Well, basically what they found was there was an electron cloud that formed in the interface of these two things. And in that electron cloud, now we start getting conduction patterns similar to what we know in metals, right? And so just another example of why, oh my goodness, you get geeked about talking about nanoscience and nanotechnology. So how did we make these materials? Well, we do atomic spray painting. And atomic spray painting is actually not too far off what we're doing. So these molecular beam epitaxy systems have canisters mounted on the side of them, and the canisters are pure elements. And then we create a plasma from that, and then using a very high-tech vacuum system, we control the deposition of the atoms in that plasma, such that we can literally make one row of atoms at a time. So I want a layer of strontium, done. Followed by a layer of titanium, done. Followed by a layer of oxygen, done. Very difficult to do because controlling oxygen in these environments is non-trivial, but we can do it. All right, and so by doing this, we can create all of these incredible patterns, right? These are transmission electron images, but I just want to emphasize to you that you are looking at atoms. It's fascinating, right? And actually, in the Millennium Science Complex, they just installed the latest and greatest high-resolution transmission electron microscope, the Titan, has resolution down to 70 picometers. All right, so nano is so 20th century. We're going to have to change the entire naming system of this center and educational process to picotechnology. No, but still, I mean, when you think, but think about that. I mean, we're talking about fractions of a bond length, right? We're talking about no longer looking at these individual dots, but actually looking at the black space in between. Wow. All right? And then, of course, it's a high-powered electron beam, which means there's lots of other things going on which we can also characterize. It's a really, really exciting time. All right? So, as you might imagine, controlling the path of atoms from some paint can to a substrate is a non-trivial thing, all right? And so I'll try to walk you through it, because the technology is fascinating. We've actually engineered the material the best we can, all right? In some of these cases, there's just nothing else we can do from the chemical point of view. The only thing that's holding us back is the technology and how to put these things together. And so if you look at this, this is several lines of pressure, so atmospheric pressure, density of molecules in a space, mean free path, this is a fascinating one I'll come back to, impingement rate, so how many molecules are hitting my substrate as a function of time, and then how many gas molecules are hitting my substrate as a function of time. Because as you might imagine, when I'm inside this chamber and I'm generating this plasma of atoms, right, there's other things inside the chamber. And they may interact with the atoms, or they may go to the substrate and prevent the atoms from getting there. And so these are some of the technical challenges that we have to overcome. So this line here represents the pressure that I need to get in terms of my vacuum technology, such that I'm assured my atom will make it to the substrate without bumping into another gas molecule. And you'll see I'm at 10 to the minus 3 millibar, right? Remembering that 10 to the 3 millibar is atmospheric pressure. So 6 orders of magnitude. And that just assures me that the atom gets to the substrate. It doesn't do anything to assure me that I'm going to have a pure substrate. So this next line is where I have to get to ensure that for every gas molecule that hits my substrate, an atom hits my substrate. This is called one Langmuir, all right? And so here I'm getting a one for one. Well, if I'm going for purity, I get 50% stuff I don't need with the 50% stuff I do need. So, and look, I'm at 10 to the minus 6, 9 orders of magnitude. Current technology, vacuum technology, has us approaching 10 to the minus 10 millibar. 10 to the minus 10. The mean free path, now, this is a great scale up. The mean free path of an atom in this environment is 300 miles. Think about that. An atom in a space that's so incredibly empty that it would have to travel 300 miles before it would bump into something else. Wow. All right. So how do we do this? Well, we have diffusion. These are the diffusion cells. This is where we actually, effusion cells, sorry. This is where we actually hold the material, the paint. Can we do this? Yes. Every element on the periodic table has the ability to be vaporized and turned into a plasma and deposited. Some obviously are much easier than others, but it can be done. And this is basically what the system looks like. So in the center, you have your substrate. You'll see on the outside, there are cans. Some of them contain elements. Some of them contain characterization techniques because, you know, while I'm doing this, I want to make sure I'm making what I intended to make. And so this system, and then there's a state-of-the-art one in the Millennium Science Complex. That's about $1 million.
Right? How big is it?
Huh?
How big is it?
It would take up about half this room.
Looks like a spaceship.
Yeah, it really does. It's really pretty. It's all highly polished stainless steel.
So it's not something you've been able to put into space yet to do?
No.
No.
So what's fascinating about this is you're going to see some other techniques over the next couple of days. CVD, chemical vapor deposition, plasma deposition. All right, these are techniques that have been around for 40 years, you know, and so to some extent, what we're talking about doing is pushing the envelope of technology with 40-year-old technology, right? Which seems sort of counterintuitive. How can I do that? Well, the way I can do that is I improve that process, all right? And so let's talk about an example of how we've been using these materials. Conduction speed, all right? Processing speed, all right? So my phone in my pocket right now has a faster processor than my first laptop computer, right? Wow. Okay? And for a fraction of the cost. That's all about electron conduction. So on the y-axis is what we call electron mobility. That's the speed of the electron. How fast can the electron get from point A to point B? So as I go up the scale, I'm getting there faster. And then on the bottom scale is temperature. And you'll notice that the temperature is incredibly cold. All right? Why would the temperature be incredibly cold? Well, what I'm trying to do is create the perfect conductor from a material point of view. All right? So if it's the perfect conductor, what that means is that nothing related to the structure of that material, the atoms, the electrons, the bonds, should get in the way of the electron going from point A to point B. The only way I can measure that is at low temperature. Because once I get up to room temperature, well, there's so much internal energy, atoms are vibrating because of the heat, and so forth and so on. Obviously, the electrons are going to get scattered and not travel as fast. So if I want to assess the perfection of my atomic structure, I do that at low temperatures, all right? And so let's look at what we're doing here. So if we think about this as an infrastructure, all right? So once again, let's try to scale it up to something that's a little more attainable. So I'm talking about building a highway, all right? That's going to be my conduction path from point A to point B. And then I want computing speed. So I need as many electrons as I can get on that highway. Let's call those cars, all right? So in a bulk situation, you have the equivalent of a highway with cars traveling at about 3 miles per hour, all right? And so the first thing, and actually the way that we got to this, because these materials don't typically have the electrons available, so the way that we got to this is by doping, all right? And the way to think about dopants is parking lots. So if I build a bunch of parking lots, that's where my cars were hanging out, then the cars can get on the highway, take the information from point A to point B. But the problem is the parking lots are right next to the highway. And so the cars get distracted and they go park for a while. That's information I'm not getting. All right? So then we started a technique called modulation doping. Basically, what we did is we moved the parking lots away. So we put all of our dopants in one area of the material. So the electrons are there, we extract them, but once we extract them, they have really no interest in going back because they can't see the parking lot anymore, all right? And this actually, so we went basically two orders of magnitude in conduction by doing that. But here's where the story gets interesting. We've now perfected that. There's nothing else we can do there. The chemistry is known, the structure is known. So now it's all about how do we make it. And so every other achievement that we have above here, and of course now we're upwards, we're approaching 10 to the 8 in mobility. All of those gains have been from technology of how we make the stuff, not the chemistry. Which as a chemist, which is how I was classically trained, blows my mind to tell me that, you know, there's just nothing else I can do. I can just throw my hands up in the air. You know, the chemistry has been perfected, all right? What I have to do now is make the technology better. And so by making that technology better, we've now gone from 3 miles per hour to 10,000 miles per hour, hypersonic scramjet, which doesn't exist. But when it does, it might be able to move as fast as the electrons I'm conducting. So we can use these techniques then to start making very unique materials. An example of this is nanowires. So there's a lot, you'll see a lot of things with nanowires, nanotubes, a lot of excitement about them because of their functionality. Nanowires in particular are interesting because, once again, we can control the chemistry inside that wire. So, and then also, we're going back to this surface area argument, all right? So let's just say for sake of argument, another scale-up problem, right? Let's say I'm making wires and they're 10 nanometers in diameter. Once again, what's that mean, 10 nanometers in diameter? What that means is that if I have a wire that's 10 nanometers in diameter, I could line up roughly 3 million of them across the width of my thumbnail. And that's just one row. Then think about the matrix you could make. All right? Then, if these wires are made out of silicon, every single one of them is capable of extracting a photon of light and turning that into an electron to do work. These are next generation solar cells. All right? And they have huge implications in terms of efficiency, because one of the problems with bulk silicon is, okay, sun hits it, electrons are generated, but those electrons have to travel what's the equivalent of hundreds of thousands of miles to get to an electrode so I can use it to do work. But if my nanowire is only 5 nanometers in diameter, well, now that electron that's generated has to go around the block to get to the electrode. All right, and so I'm going to extract much more efficiency from that cell. Not only that, but imagine that I create a wire that doesn't conduct electricity. Well, that doesn't sound like a lot of fun. But what if the wire would conduct electricity when it was in the presence of other environments? All right, so we can make wires that, yeah, they don't conduct unless they're in the presence of ammoniated compounds. Then they conduct really well. What am I now looking for? Dirty bombs. All right? And once again, 3 million across the width of my thumbnail, and that's just one row. How many of those could I put in a wand that's, you know, about yay big and run around your piece of luggage in the airport? All right? So you start to see how, you know, once again, these huge implications. All right? Pregnancy test. We now have pregnancy tests that claim the ability to detect the beginning of pregnancy, the onset of pregnancy, before the woman's first missed menstrual cycle, right? How can we do that? Well, on the tip of this stick are literally millions of gold colloids that are, you know, 5 to 8 nanometers in diameter. And attached to each one of those is the DNA base pair that's complementary to the DNA that's being produced hormonally because of the onset of the pregnancy. All right? And so we're able to, once again, think about the thumbnail. All right? 3 million just in one row. How many rows? All right? And every single one of them is looking for this one DNA sequence. So it's basically you have literally tens of millions of people all looking for the same needle in the haystack. And so as a consequence, you have a much better chance of finding it. It's going into things like cosmetics, all right? So this company, Fees, makes a makeup that's based on zinc oxide, all right? Zinc oxide has wonderful absorption of UVA and UVB radiation. But unfortunately, for those of us who grew up in the 70s and 80s, you also know that zinc oxide's not very transparent. And so you walk around with these white streaks and white noses and stuff, and yeah, it didn't burn, but it also looked sort of silly. But everyone else looked silly too, so it didn't really matter. But now, they're making the zinc oxide particles so small, they no longer interact with the visible light. So they're now transparent to the human eye. And so these makeups, the whole idea is that you could be wearing your regular makeup and yet you're completely protected from the harmful rays of the sun, but no one knows because, you know, nothing looks any different. Yes?
I'm really glad to see this chemical-free, too. That's really, it takes no matter what.
Yeah, I know. Define chemical, right?
Yeah. Nothing.
I work with really small stuff. Okay. Oh, man. You know, and you still get students write that in reports, too. The difference was small. Oh, really? But, you know, define small, right? You know? Sports equipment.
Right in front of you.
Yeah. The stealth bat. I don't know why it's stealth, because, I mean, when it hits the ball, you're still going to hear it. But anyway. So, we all understand this concept, right? I want to generate power and speed. I hit a ball. The ball rebounds off of this, goes long way. Everybody celebrates me. All right? But there's a problem in the transfer of energy, right? So I generate all this great power, but, you know, the ball's moving too. And it goes back into the bat. Ball doesn't go as far. All right? So what did Easton do? Well, they took some of the weight out of the bat by putting in carbon fiber technology. Now I have a bat that I can swing a lot faster. I'm generating a lot more momentum. Problem. Carbon fibers are held together by an epoxy. The epoxy has very little structural integrity. So as a consequence, yeah, I'm swinging this thing a lot faster, but the ball is making this bat deflect a lot more because of the loss of stiffness with the carbon fiber. So what Easton did is they took carbon nanotubes and they impregnated their epoxy with those nanotubes. And as a consequence, they stiffened the epoxy by orders of magnitude. So now I have lightweight, swing fast, and I'm going to transfer more of the energy into the ball instead of absorbing that. So nanotechnology...
That's a pretty good swing.
Oh, thank you. We see it in golf, all right? Here, the mechanics are actually quite simple, all right? Something that's closer to 100% dense is going to be able to transfer the energy more efficiently than something that is full of voids. And so companies are using nanoparticulates of metals, and they're depositing them onto the face, creating a 100% dense layer, better transfer of energy. What's fascinating is they're doing it with a technology that's, once again, decades and decades old. We've been making bathtubs this way for 40, 50 years, all right? It's electrophoretic deposition. Basically, you cause the face of the golf club to become one pole. You have your source, which is another pole, and you get a transfer of charged particles. This is how we put enamel coatings on bathtubs, right? But when we started doing this for nanotechnology, all of a sudden electrophoretic deposition was just the greatest thing since sliced white bread, even though it had been around for 40, 50 years. Sort of funny how these things, these fads come and go. And it has an impact. I agree this is not, you know, necessarily all nanotechnology, but it's fascinating to me how nanotechnology is changing the way we play games. Right? This was an article out of the USA Today showing the change in driving distance of professional golfers, right? And this is sort of an interesting thing, right? Because, well, let's think about football, right? If I think about an offensive lineman in football from 1980 to 2004, what do I think about? Somebody's gotten a lot bigger and a lot faster, all right? If I think about golfers from 1980 to 2004, I don't imagine, you know, men and women 300 pounds, you know, bench pressing 500 pounds. That's not what's out there. It's the same people that have been out there for the last 20 years. Yet, the ball is going significantly farther. Why? Technology impacting the game. And of course, this isn't even giving credit to the golf ball itself, which is also contributing to that. But never want your feet to stink again. All right? So ARC outdoor socks. They have, so silver has antimicrobial properties. We've known this for years, all right? In fact, in the 60s, during the Vietnam War, the military tried to put silver into the socks of soldiers by literally weaving in silver wire into the sock.
From Vietnam, yeah, we got a pair to show to the kids, the silver weaving.
Yeah, and not very comfortable. Why did they do that? Well, the problem is silver is not really interested in mating with anything that's organic, all right? But what happens if we make the silver particles, you know, 20 nanometers? Well, now your whole opinion of mating with inorganic or organic things changes entirely. And now you can, so they encapsulate them. And so we get the same thing, but now we don't have to walk on wires. And, you know, this technology, what's fascinating is it can do multiple things. So here, I'm showing you, these are polymers. And what this is the next generation of not only polymer membrane fuel cells, but water purification, all right? What they're able to do with these polymers is the green dots are the hydrophobic part, so hates water, and the blue part is the hydrophilic, all right? So in a fuel cell, I can organize these layers to transport ions and nothing else. But in water filtration systems, I can organize microstructures to transport water, but extract anything out of the water that I don't want in there. All right? And so it's really, you know, so this is Dr. Hickner's group here at Penn State. So they're doing both at the same time, which is absolutely fascinating. So they're contributing to alternative energies, and they're also making sure that everyone has potable water to drink. And this, I just show you this because this is really just scientists showing off. But the architectures that they can design are absolutely mind-boggling. I mean, really, it borders on art. In fact, you can find some of these images in places like the Guggenheim and stuff like that, where science meets art. But, you know, there's just the technical control that they have is really, really impressive. Now, that's manipulating the polymer chains themselves, but what if I impregnate the polymer with something to give it better properties? And so this is polymer nanocomposites, and actually they're using dirt, all right? Really, really nice dirt, but it's dirt nonetheless, all right? They take clay, and they basically separate the layers of the clay to create these nano tablets of clay, so it looks like a tabletop, kind of a lot of surface area on top and bottom, but very thin. And then they impregnate the polymer with these, and what happens is you start to increase lots of properties by orders of magnitude. All right, and let's see how some of those go. So here's the Wilson double core tennis ball, which claims to have a tennis ball with a life 4 times longer than the typical, tennis ball. Why? Because it doesn't allow the air to leak out from the inside of the tennis ball. I mean, eventually it does, but it's an incredibly torturous path, right? As I've drawn with that arrow there. So now that the air just didn't go from point A to point B, it has to go around its elbow to get to its knee. All right, and so as a consequence, it holds on to the air much longer. And we've used this technology already. This is the lion heart. So this was the artificial heart developed in coordination with this campus and Hershey to keep heart replacement patients alive until they get their heart to for the heart transplant. The shoes, all right? Lots of our shoes are now filled with air that makes our step nice and light and bouncy. How does the air stay there? These polymer nanocomposites. And then finally, talk about orders of magnitude increase. Ford and GM are now using these as body panels in their cars. So they're actually pieces of plastic, but they have the same impact strength as the sheet steel they're replacing. But now you're going from something that has a density of 8 grams per milliliter cubed to something that's like 1.2. So you have a weight savings of 8 times, all right? Now my car is more efficient because the engine's not pulling as much weight, and I haven't sacrificed safety. The other thing that these clay nanoparticles do is they give the polymers thermal properties that polymers have never had before, all right? So here's an example. So as you go up the picture, they've added more of these organoclay particles, and what do you see? Not only do you see better flame resistance, but you also see better char integrity. So yeah, it burns, but the char doesn't fall away, exposing more virgin material to catch fire. It stays intact, all right? And so as a consequence, I'm improving not only the flammability, but also the ability for the fire to burn out. And then finally, this is really funny, especially if you're a dog person. So there's a kitty sitting on top of a piece of polycarbonate, all right? And that polycarbonate has approximately 5 weight percent clay nanoparticles. You see it sitting on top of a Bunsen burner. The flame is red, so you know, we're not talking serious temperatures here, but we're definitely talking above 300 C. Like
PETA hasn't gotten all over them?
No.
For that picture?
No animals were harmed in the taking of that photograph. Another one you'll see is a rose. I like the cat better. But you'll also see other images where they have a nice, beautiful rose, and of course it's not wilting or anything. And then here's one just for the disgusting factor of nanotechnology, chocolate-flavored chewing gum, which I just think would be ugh. But anyway, have you ever thought about it? Why isn't there chocolate-flavored chewing gum? Well, the reason is that the fats in the chocolate actually break down the elastomer in the gum. And so as a consequence, as soon as you mixed the two, it would be like chewing a Tic Tac, all right? So what this company did is they actually encapsulated the chocolate so to protect the elastomer from the fats of the chocolate. And so when you chew it, you get the flavor of the chocolate, but the gum doesn't break down as quickly. But once again, I don't know, it's all ideas. And then finally, I would argue, and I think, you know, Jim Adair will back me up on this in a couple of days, the greatest impact that nanoscience and nanotechnology is going to have is medicine. It's already revolutionizing the way that we do medicine. And there's so many different ways that we can explore it. From surgical tools, so these are These are tools that Adair's group is making. The idea here is less invasive surgeries. So I make a small incision, I insert a tube, and the tube is millimeters in size. But contained within that tube are orifices which contain multiple tools. So I could insert one tube, and in there would be a camera, a light, a pair of tweezers, something to cut with, and it's all going inside an incision that's literally a couple of millimeters. All right. And of course, anytime we open up the human body and expose it to the outside elements, you run the risk of infection. So any surgery that could be done, you know, by a less invasive procedure has a greater chance of speedy recovery, as well as not dying after the fact because, you know, the infection killed you. Yeah, cured the disease, but the infection killed you. So, and they're doing these things with, you know, they're doing this once again with particles. These particles are on the order of 10 to 20 nanometers in size, smaller than viruses, smaller than bacteria. And they're using these particles in a multitude of ways. I won't go into the details because, once again, Adair will talk about that. But they're using them to help image. So now something like an MRI could be used to look at cancer tumors when they're literally cells old. Not when it's the size of a marble or a golf ball or a tennis ball, but when it's cells old. All right, and MRI is a pretty common technique nowadays. You'd be hard-pressed to go to a hospital that doesn't have this imaging capability. And now I think that we could use something that's so commonplace to look for and diagnose things that are, you know, literally nanoscale. All right? I'll end with this. The other thing that's really exciting about what we do in material science and engineering, especially at this department, and on this campus, is we get our students involved. And so this is a project. It was a senior thesis of a young woman, Erica Martin, who's now just completed her first year of medical school. And she spent 4 years investigating amylose. So amylose is a starch in potatoes. Potatoes are one of the last things that the body's digestive system breaks down. And the reason is because the enzymes to metabolize that amylose are at the end of the intestinal tract. And so the idea was, well, we treat intestinal and colon cancers typically by oral medicines. The problem is their efficacy or their efficiency is really poor. Why? Because the medicine has to travel through the entire digestive tract, gets the crap beat out of it, and so by the time it gets there, it's just not very effective. So the idea was, well, let's encapsulate the drug in the amylose. All right? So amylose forms this helix. You can insert the drug inside. Now it's protected from the body's digestive system until it gets to the end, which is where I wanted to deposit it anyway, and then the body's going to break it down naturally. All right. One of the neat things about this nanotechnology for medicine is we're now bypassing all of the poor things that we do now. Right. So chemo and radiation treat cancer. Yeah, it's effective, but it also kills everything else around the cancer cell. Right. So I'm killing lots of good stuff to kill the bad stuff, and people get very sick. All right. These techniques, that doesn't happen anymore. The body's immune system doesn't even know they're there. There's no response. All right? So anyway, after 4 years, not only were they able to show proof of concept of being able to encapsulate these drugs, they also found some really interesting self-assembly possibilities, which you will hear more about with respect to nanotechnology and having things be able to be organized as you control the environment around them. So what was really cool about this, though, is when she went through all of her med school interviews, it was like one of the easiest processes she'd ever been through, because every interview was about her talking about this research that she had been doing for 4 years. And the people on the panel thinking, oh my God, here is somebody for the last 4 years who's been doing research on something she'll probably be using 10 years from now, you know? And so, you know, when you talk about, you know, bringing a different perspective, right? So even if you have a student that's really interested in science because they want to be a med student and a doctor one day, still doesn't negate encouraging them to study this area. All right, still doesn't negate studying engineering instead of being a biology major. All right, nothing that there's against biology, but, you know, think about it. I mean, seriously, I mean, your whole goal is to go to med school. You get to med school, you find out, it's really not what I thought it was. All right, well, now what do you fall back on, a BS degree in biology or a BS degree in engineering? I can tell you which one of those is going to get a job quicker. I won't say it since I'm on camera. Always recruiting, sorry, always recruiting. You know, it's a small field, so we have to do what we can, which is one of the reasons that I like being involved in this, because honestly, you're the people that are going to help us find these students, all right? I mean, it's really making an impact, and we've actually changed our curriculum because of it, all right? So many more students were coming in, and they weren't talking about metals, polymers, and ceramics. Hell, they didn't even know what they were. What they were talking about was nanotechnology, biomaterials, energy, all right? And so as a consequence, we went away from being materials-centric, you know, and saying ceramics, metals, polymers, to, hey, let's learn about all of them so you can go attack medicine, and you can go attack, you know, materials in the human body, and you can go attack energy and sustainability and things of that nature. So I think, you know, that's, to me, that's a really important point, you know? I mean, kids get interested in this for all different types of reasons, but it doesn't negate them still studying nanotechnology. It doesn't negate them still studying engineering. And honestly, that's where the future is going to be. So anyway, thank you for your attention. Appreciate the opportunity. And
we'll take a couple of questions now, but hopefully people want to take a break and then come back.
I have a question. So what I'm hearing is you're just basically teaching the application of material, ceramics, and polymer rather than the material by itself. Is that what I'm hearing?
No, I'm still teaching the science behind why those materials do what they do. The difference is I'm teaching them in the point of view of how am I going to take advantage of that. All right. The fact of the matter is that the challenges that face us as a society are not going to be solved by one metal or one ceramic or one polymer. They're going to be solved by taking the best of all of those and trying to mitigate the worst. And so really, the fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, our students face the same thing that Bob was talking about with respect to nanotechnology, right? I want to study nanotechnology. Mom goes and looks at jobs for nanotechnology, doesn't find any titles, right? Same thing with material science and engineering. You very rarely see the job title material scientist. What you see is production engineer, quality control, things of that nature. And it's because of the reason our students are hired is because of their subset of skills, and that is they carry around a massive problem-solving toolbox. Because the difference between them and any other engineer is they understand the atomic scale. So in other words, they're in a steel manufacturing plant, and all of a sudden the steel is not meeting the mechanical properties it was supposed to. The material science students will be able to walk that line and look at that furnace and say, you see that furnace? That furnace is 5 degrees higher than it was yesterday, and as a consequence, we're no longer precipitating out the second phase we needed, and so now our steel is weaker. You know, that's the kind of thing, you know, so basically, we teach them the science behind why the atoms do what they do, so that they can then use that to solve engineering problems, typically on production manufacturing scale. Yes?
I have a question about safety. When you do these nanoscale experiments, mm-hmm. you know, they are so small, it's going to go through like any regular gloves and skin, even these nanochemicals. So how do you handle safety?
That's a good question. So there are glove and protection technologies that are catching up with the nanoscale science. The other thing is that we do these experiments in much more controlled environments. So the idea, you know, the days of doing desktop experiments are going away. One, because of safety. One, because of contamination. I mean, once again, if I'm trying to create structures on the order of nanometers, then, you know, I mean, a piece of dust, if you see, you'll get to see a piece of dust, I'm sure, when you go into a scanning electron microscope. Those things are freaking huge. right? When I compare, you know, I mean, it's a piece of dust, right? That's why size is relative. So, yeah, dust, I can't even see it. But, you know, I collect a sample of this air, I put it in a scanning electron microscope, and what you will see are boulders compared to the little tiny grains of sand that I'm trying to work with. So, so clean room space is becoming a major consideration. Hood space, glove box space. The consequence is, huh?
A lot of remote stuff that you don't really directly...
And not as much, but that, you know, but the point is that it's all becoming much more expensive to do. Because you, once again, I can't take a couple of beakers and sit here on the tabletop. That's not entirely true. I can take a couple of beakers and right here in front of you make nanoparticles. It's really trivial. Once again, the challenge is keeping them apart once you've made them. But, it's the safety aspect and just the general expense of doing this kind of work is getting increasingly challenging.
We make nanoscale, like those, dyes, solar dyes.
Yes,
titanium oxide.
Yes.
But, you know, there, we just use bare hands to mix titanium oxide.
Yeah.
And, you know, we, I guess, just breathing all that in the nanoparticles.
It's a solution, all
right? Mm-hmm. But to make solution. So I'm really concerned when we do this.
Yeah. And unfortunately, titanium is pretty inert. they were surrounded by it, right? So, I mean, like in the walls and stuff, paints.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's definitely something you have to think about. But, you know, part of safety, part of the equation of safety is also exposure time. So there are other things that you can do to minimize those things. But that's a great, you know, that one I'd be less concerned about, and it's a great experiment that you can do with the students, and it's not that messy. Another experiment that I like to do is make homemade alkaline batteries, and that's a wonderful way of driving home this surface area change, because you can get manganese oxide in various sizes, particle sizes. So I'll get some particles that are on the order of tens of micrometers, and then I'll make an alkaline battery, and then I'll get some that's on the order of a few hundred nanometers, and you'll actually see an increase in the current coming out of that homemade battery. So there's a lot of really things you can do, and there's still plenty of inert things that you can work with.
Great, thank you very much. You're gonna be around for a little bit. We appreciate that.